In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about juvenile justice. Our guest for the program is Stephen Kossman. He is Director of Probation for Peoria County. He is also past president of the National Juvenile Detention Association and also of the Colorado Youth Alternatives Initiative. We'll be talking about some of the basic issues and also, of course, welcome questions and comments from people who are listening. If you'd like to join the conversation, all you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for asking me, David.
It seems to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that for at least about 100 years, we have maintained two justice systems, one for juveniles and one for adults. And while those two things overlap, at least there's this idea that we have the approach is different, and that while we may indeed have given up on the idea that adult criminals can be rehabilitated, we still are trying to hold on to the notion that children and adolescents can, and that we ought to do everything that we can to provide them whatever they need so that they grow up to be adults and not get into trouble. Although in recent years, it also seems that we're starting to drift away from the notion that young people can be rehabilitated, as we see more and more sort of a move towards trying children as adults, to the idea that we might sentence young people to death and so forth. And I guess I'm just wondering, as a way of starting, to have you talk a little bit about that notion. Are we indeed starting to give up on the idea that young offenders can be rehabilitated?
Well, I like to describe it as the adultification of the juvenile justice system. We've blurred the lines to the degree that that the juvenile system is a mirror image of the adult system now. Mm-hmm. I started out in this business 33 years ago, and when I came into the business, I mean, it's impossible for me to look back and look at what we're doing with now and not see what's happened. When I started out in the business, we wanted to help kids. We wanted to make up for what wasn't in their life. We wanted to build competencies. We wanted to nurture them. We wanted to put a safety net around them. That's how we dealt with juveniles in the juvenile justice system. And that was the heritage of the juvenile justice system. As you said, since 1899, the first juvenile court was in Cook County in Chicago. Mm-hmm. In the 33 years I've been in this business, it's changed dramatically. And what's changed is that the majority of kids, when I came into the business, were white kids, and we wanted to help them. Now the majority of the kids are children of color, and we don't nearly as much want to help them as we want to punish them. And it's impossible for me to step away from it and look at it and not recognize that. The offenses, the categories of offenses have changed. There's been a kind of a bracket shift in the kinds of offenses we see. But that doesn't come close to explaining why we would want to treat juveniles as adults.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a set of offenses. There are things that we call status offenses that are crimes if committed by juveniles that if they were committed by, they wouldn't even be a crime if an adult did it, like running away.
Right.
Then there are those things that I suppose that we have always thought of as adult crimes, particularly violent crimes like rape and homicide and armed robbery and so forth. I think there is this perception that juvenile offenders have become more violent. They are committing more violent crimes, those things that perhaps in the past we thought of as adult crimes, and I suppose that distinction is pretty artificial, but that perhaps the drive to be more punitive comes from this perception that young offenders are posing a greater threat. Is that in fact true?
Well, let's go back 15 years. Juveniles certainly pose less threat now than they did 15 years ago. So do adults. You know, the crime has dropped. Crime rate, especially among violent crimes and homicides, have dropped dramatically in that period of time. Again, what the reality is doesn't explain our movement. It's perception, and as you said, the perception that there's danger. That certainly is the case, and it is that perception that has driven this kind of movement. If we look at the children who have been tried in adult courts and transferred to the adult system, they're not in that category of rapists and murderers. They're much more in the category of substance abuse and drugs. And property offenses and, you know, habitual property offenses, but they're not the dangerous, we're afraid of them people. We've painted juveniles with this broad stroke with this perception of how bad it is. And I think I can explain that fairly simply. Juveniles are responsible for about 12% of the violent offenses in the United States, about 12%. Now, if there were 100 offenses last year in a jurisdiction, that means 12 of them would have been committed by juveniles. If this year 15 were committed by juveniles, and last year 88 were committed by adults, and this year 99 committed by adults, the numerical increase is 11 on the adult side, but a 12% increase. The increase is the numerical 3 in the juvenile side, but a 25% increase. And the way that would be portrayed is that the juvenile offense rate is increasing at twice the rate that the adult rate is. And it's the terror of small numbers.
Yeah.
And it's what those kinds of percentages mean when it gives us a perception, but it's not the reality.
Yeah. Well, that it does parallel, though, what I have been reading about the crime statistics, and that is that in recent years, the numbers of juvenile offenders who were found guilty of violent crimes has actually declined, but at the same time, the numbers that are incarcerated has actually increased. So then I guess that does invite the question, and you've touched on it, is, well, why are these kids in trouble? What have they been found guilty of? And if we were talking about nonviolent crimes, then what is it that we're talking about?
Well, let's talk about the average kid in juvenile detention in the United States, and I can give you a description of that juvenile. He's male. 75% are male, 25% female. Now, that's changed. When I came into this 33 years ago, only 10% of the detained population was female. Now it's 25%. So that's a dramatic shift. The average kid's 15 years old, reads at a fourth grade level, does math at a third grade level. In the long-term studies that Northwestern University, Dr. Linda Teplin, has led with the Cook County Juvenile Detention Facility, of the kids in that facility, they found that 80% of those kids are diagnosable in DSM-4. Now, what that means is that and about half of those are substance abuse issues, but half of those are serious mental health issues. So that means about 40% of the kids coming through the Cook County Juvenile Detention Facility have serious mental health issues. Now, some of those are less serious, but some of them are truly psychoses. And you have a disproportionate number of kids who have severe attention deficit. People who work in detention would tell you some of the kids that we deal with have not yet had their first attention span. You know, they've been bumped around. That average kid's 15 reads at a fourth grade level, but when we test them, they have average intelligence. Now, what does that tell us? You know, they've been bounced around so much. The average family in America moves every 4 years. That's the average family. The average family of a kid in a juvenile detention center in the United States, their family moves 3 or 4 times a year. You know, it's rare that a kid in the system completed an entire year in a single school. They get bounced around a lot. You know, their older brothers were in the system. Their fathers were in the system. You know, it's a multi-generational issue, and it has much more to do with abject poverty and hopelessness than it does with to any other factor.
Hmm. Well, if we set some of those things aside as being something that maybe the justice system is not going to be able to deal with, but it's enough if we look at the fact that we have children and young people who maybe at the very least have gone to bad school. But and layered on top of that, they may have some learning disabilities. They may have some genuine mental illness issues. They may have substance abuse. All those sorts of things. That if they didn't have those, if they came from a more stable, more advantaged background and went to a better school, maybe they wouldn't have gotten into trouble. So then it prompts this question: well, other than putting them in some kind of detention and getting them off the street for a while, does the system have anything to offer them in terms of counseling and special education and perhaps drug rehab therapy or, you know, something that's actually constructive that would get at some of these underlying issues?
Well, if you're talking about within the juvenile justice system, we have to talk about two different parts of it. Pre-adjudication, that's before the person has been to court and been found guilty. And then post-disposition, after they've been found guilty and then are placed on probation or into a treatment program and such. Before that finding of guilt, we have no right to impose treatment, but we can have programs and services. So within a juvenile detention facility, if we recognize the children that we're dealing with, we know that we have to have mental health services available. We know that there's a high suicide risk of kids who are locked up. We know that we have to have tools to assess that kind of risk and to have in place at all times mental health services for the kids. And then transition to the free community to continue those services where we've diagnosed a real need. So in terms of those two parts of the system, pre-adjudication and post-adjudication, it seems to me that the pre-adjudication portion has to be a diagnostic time, has to be when we assess what are the needs here, what are the issues here, and what are we going to suggest to the court as strategies to deal with them. Some jurisdictions are very good at that in the United States. Other jurisdictions don't do it at all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have that mixture across the state of Illinois.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Stephen Kossmann. He's director of probation for Peoria County. He's the past president of the National Juvenile Detention Association and also of the Colorado Youth Alternatives Initiative and has been working in this area of juvenile justice for a long time. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You want to talk a little bit about the Colorado Youth Alternatives Initiative?
Well, the National Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative is the project that we're currently involved in. The Annie E. Casey Foundation identified that children in need, children at risk for being involved in the juvenile justice system, are a population that were underserved and that there was an over-reliance on detention, on locking up kids, and that we can create other kinds of alternatives in the community that are less expensive and more appropriate for the risk that the child represents to the community and not make the community any less safe. Ensure that the juvenile appears for their court appearances and begin a diagnostic process to identify what are the needs and what can we do for this juvenile. What kinds of competencies do they need to have built and what kinds of services do they need?
Mm-hmm. Well, what sort of resources does that take? And I would imagine that a lot of places they would say, you know, that to do something more than prosecution and incarceration would be nice, but we don't have the money to do it. Now, I suppose one could also make the argument that the penny wise, pound foolish argument says, well, you pay me now or you pay me later. And if we can do something to keep kids out of the system, then in the long run, it's going to save us money. But that argument doesn't always seem to work very well. What are the resource issues, and is the money actually there to do the kinds of things that you would like to see done?
Well, I think the resources are there. It's a matter of whether the will is there, and whether the perception that there are other alternative ways to deal with these matters that potentially hold the much better outcomes for juveniles and for the community, because we have to recognize that the juveniles in the system are part of our community, and they're going to be a burden on our community forever if we don't find ways to build their competencies and to, in a sense, make up for what isn't in their life. The majority of kids who are habitually involved in the system, they have no esperanza, no hope for the future. In their world, things don't get better. In their world, it's not a shameful thing to get sent to a state institution. It's happened in my family before. It's going to happen again, and it's what happens to you at some point or other. And, you know, sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. And when you go to get locked up, that's just one of the times you lose. Well, we have to find ways, creative ways, to help those children understand that they're a part of our community and that we care for them and that we want them to have a better life. And the resources, that was your question, is mm-hmm. do we have those resources? It costs, on average in Illinois, about $125 a day to keep a juvenile locked up in a detention facility. It costs about $7 to $11 a day to supervise that juvenile in the community and get them involved in some other kinds of services. So it's clearly cheaper strategy. The issue is net widening. And when we create alternatives, we have to be absolutely certain that we don't then start putting kids into the system that otherwise wouldn't have been there. If it's an alternative to detention, it has to be certain that that juvenile would have been held in detention if it were not for those services, and then provide the services. Otherwise, we've just widened the net, and we still keep the same kids locked in detention that we had, and we just put other kids into these programs. Mm-hmm. That's the danger.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone listening this morning in Indiana on our line number 4. Let's do that. Hello.
For a minute there, I thought you were going to go jump right on the question I had, but you got very close to it, and that's when you were talking about the milieu of the neighborhood where that's the way life is, man, that you win, you lose, and you get through the losers, and there'll be some more winners coming down your way. In a sense, in the personnel you have, it just seems to be an incredible problem. How in the hell do you get to a child in a concreted, 4x8 or 6x10 or whatever they are now, and to explain to him when he goes back to his neighborhood, all those other people are wrong, and I'm here from 8 to 5, and I'm right. I know that's a problem. I just wondered if what people are doing about it now.
That's a good question, and your perception is accurate. If we are a 9-to-5 operation, we increase the problem instead of helping it. Another aspect of kind of as an overlay to this overarching issue is we have to have people working in the system that reflect the people that are being treated in the system or dealt with in the system. So we have to make certain that juveniles who come in contact with the system see people working with them who look like them, who come from their neighborhood. If we have volunteers in our juvenile detention center, we make certain that we get some senior citizens in who have grown up in the same neighborhood and have made it and are productive members of society, because oftentimes what happens is the kids see somebody that doesn't look like them, doesn't talk like them, isn't from their neighborhood, and they're just talking some crazy talk that the kid just sits and nods at us because we're in a position of authority, and that's what you do if you want that person to go away, is you just nod and agree with them. Mm-hmm. What we try to do is make certain that we're dealing with the realities of the child's life and those kinds of temptations that are there, and that we can help them see that there are viable alternatives. Now, of course, what is important in that is that there are viable alternatives. And in many ways, we have to help create that kind of safety net that doesn't exist for many kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there some place that you'd point to in the state of Illinois that you think has been particularly successful at doing what we've been talking about doing?
There are several, but I'd say the biggest success, and I think most of us from south of I-80 look at Cook County and say, well, that doesn't relate to the rest of us because those kids really are tougher and there really is more problems. Well, let's look at them. In Cook County, they have a juvenile detention facility that has 498 beds. 6 years ago, they were averaging 800 kids in that facility. For the last year, every day in the last year, they've averaged under their capacity in the facility, less than 500 kids in the facility. And it's through the creation of alternatives and community involvement and partnership with indigenous organizations in the community to create services for kids as an alternative to having them locked up. And they haven't, they've experienced, as a matter of fact, a higher rate of appearance in court. With a very simple program of contacting the family personally by phone and reminding them of their need to appear in court and of, you know, just before their appearance is necessary, like the day before. That helps tremendously because many of the people that we're dealing with don't have that calendar on the front of their refrigerator color-coded for each of their activities. You know, they're struggling, and that kind of personal contact helps a lot, especially if services are available from people that they recognize who are from their neighborhood, live in their community, and work in their community. It makes a lot of difference. In Dallas, Texas, as an example, we would send a probation officer out with their clipboard looking for mama to come get their son from the detention center because the juvenile could be released, and we couldn't find mama. But when we realized that maybe we weren't the right ones to find mom, that if we contracted with a group from the community to do that work, guess what happened? Within 30 minutes, mom or an auntie would be at the detention center to pick up the child. Because instead of someone as a position of authority that was coming to their door and they didn't know why, instead it was somebody that they recognized from down the block or from their church or their community center who was coming to their door and offering some assistance, helping with their child.
Hmm. That seems like that's a big hurdle to get over, and sort of a historic perception of the system as being not much good and something to be avoided, you know, contact with the system and people who work for the system, something to be avoided, not the idea that these are people and it's a system that you can try and work with to some constructive end. I mean, how long does it take to get people over that hurdle that says, yeah, when the guy comes to the door, if he's somebody that I don't recognize, or if he looks like some kind of, doesn't have to be wearing a uniform, you can tell, then I'm not going to answer the door. I mean, how long does it take to get over something like that?
Well, there are several steps to it, and each of them have to be in place in order to get past that. And the initial one is, who do we recruit and hire into positions who are essentially lifeguards in the lives that we're putting into the lives of other people? You know, what we've done historically is we've hired people to be lifeguards that are non-swimmers. They couldn't begin to survive in the environment in which the kids come from. You know, we have to have people who are culturally competent, who understand what it is to deal with the problems that the people that they're serving have, to recognize that we as people who work in the system aren't terribly impressive in and of ourselves. It's our caring for them that's impressive. And people aren't in the system, juveniles and their parents aren't crazy. If we show them that we care about them and want to help them, we have success. If we aren't able to get past that barrier, you know, we're just blowing in the wind.
You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that the average juvenile in the system now is a 15-year-old boy.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
But that one of the things that you have seen in recent years is there has been an increase in the number of girls. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm just interested in what anybody's thinking about why that is.
I don't think people are at least I'm not seeing much in the literature about why that is. More what we're seeing is just that it is, and how are we going to respond to it? Because there are gender issues there, and the same kind of answer for a boy is a different answer than it is for a girl. Let me give you a simple oversimplification of it. If we take a boy from the juvenile detention center to court for a detention hearing, and their mother comes to that hearing, and they hear the mother tell the court, I don't want him, you keep him, I can't do anything with him. Now, we can predict that when we get back to the detention center, what's going to happen is sometime in the next couple of hours, that boy is going to hit somebody or something because he's hurt. And his response to hurting is to strike out. Now, let's take an example of a girl that we take from the detention center to the court. She hears her mother say, I don't want her. I can't do anything with her. You keep her. Now, how is she going to respond when she gets back to the detention center? She's going to be very emotional. She's going to be crying, and she's going to not want to be around the other kids. Now, how do we respond to the girl? We sit down with her. We talk her through it. We talk to her about, you know, the positive things in her life and possibilities for the future. And how do we respond to the boy? We wrestle him down to the floor, and we put him in a security room. They're both dealing with the same thing. Their feelings are hurt. They're hurt because the only person in their life that is their caregiver doesn't want them, at least at the moment doesn't want them. So in terms of how do we respond, well, we really need to respond to the boy more the way we did with the girl in anticipation of how he's going to feel and his hurt feelings. We have to talk about, you know, what that felt like. And, you know, what your impulses are. I know you're angry right now. You know, let's go in this room and sit and talk for a while and do that. The same thing that we found that, you know, in a way, having more females in juvenile detention facilities has better humanized our environment.
We are just a little bit past the midpoint of this hour of Focus 580, talking about juvenile justice with Stephen Kossman. He's director of probation for Peoria County and is also past president of the National Juvenile Detention Association. And if you have questions, comments, you want to be involved in a conversation, just pick up the telephone and call the number 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think that it's true that in the past, now it may be some time though, but one of the big issues was having various jurisdictions having some place to put juveniles when they needed to put them someplace. And the big issue was that we didn't want juveniles to be incarcerated with adult criminals for a variety of reasons, there was the possibility for abuse. There was a possibility for kind of education that we didn't really want to take place, that there maybe, again, it goes back to this idea that adult criminals and young offenders are different. We want to treat them differently and that we ought to have some different way of housing them. Is that still a problem, juveniles in adult jails?
It is, and it is to greater degrees and lesser degrees from state to state and jurisdiction to jurisdiction. In Illinois, there are a number of jurisdictions that do use their jails to hold juveniles. They do hold them separately, and if they're hold them longer than 40 hours, then they have to meet the standards, same standards as the juvenile detention facilities have to meet in terms of programming and services that are available. And part of the reason, well, let's just go with the most basic reason why we want to keep juveniles separate from adults. If you look at the teenage juvenile population, if you look at Anglo males in the teenage years, the number two cause of death is suicide. If you look at African-American males, the number three cause of death is suicide during the teenage years. And for Hispanic males, it's the number four cause of death. Now, if you recognize as well that when someone is locked up, they are six times more likely to hurt themselves than they are in the free community. Now, these are statistical truths. Mm-hmm. If a juvenile is held in an adult facility, they are 36 times more likely to hurt themselves than they are in the free community. 36 times more likely. And if it is the number two, number three, and number four cause of death, respectively, it's a serious issue, and it's one that's almost insurmountable. You literally, in our facility in Peoria, for instance, we check on kids who are considered a risk for suicide. We check on them every 4 minutes. Maximum amount of time between room checks is 4 minutes. Why? The number one way that people try to hurt themselves is some form of asphyxiation, some kind of choking of themselves or hanging of themselves. Brain death happens in 4 minutes through asphyxiation. So if we do room checks maximum every 4 minutes, we will catch 99.999% of attempts before they are successful. And that's about as good as we can do. But it's recognizing that that's a need. In jails, if you remember, probably the case that most people listening would remember was the O.J. case. Remember they had O.J. on suicide watch while he was in jail? And if you remember, how long were the room checks? They talked to us about it was every 15 minutes instead of the normal every 30 minutes. Well, you can see where I'm going with this. Mm-hmm. If you're checking on a juvenile every 15 minutes and that juvenile is 36 times more likely to hurt themselves while they're locked up in an adult facility, then that child could be dead four times before you come back and check on them. You know, these are serious issues. And we have to address them. Yeah.
What accounts for that big difference in the likelihood of an attempted suicide or self-injury when they're in the adult facility? Is it just that something about the atmosphere of the place is so much more intimidating?
It's more intimidating. The other people are more frightening to them. If you think about the juveniles who are habitually involved in the system, who have been to a detention facility or been locked up before, those juveniles disproportionately have been in environments where older people, adults, have abused them. Both physically and sexually. Now, here's another somewhat shocking. In some ways, it's predictable. In other ways, I think it jars us. If we look at the kids habitually involved, now, there are no studies of this nationwide, so it's an overgeneralization to say it is. But in the Pacific Northwest specifically, there have been studies about the kids in juvenile detention facilities. And here's one of the things they found. The girls who are habitually involved in the system, greater than 90% have been physically abused. Greater than 95% have been sexually abused. Now, does that surprise us? I don't think anybody really, they nod in understanding of that or in recognition of that. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about the boys. Greater than 90% have been physically abused. Greater than 70% have been sexually abused. Now, that's one that kind of surprises people. We knew this about girls, but we didn't know about the boys. And who sexually abuses them? Again, it's a person in a position of being a caretaker. It's someone in a relationship with their natural mother who abuses them. And there are men out there who are pedophiles who prey on women who are single parents because they're not so much interested in the woman as they are interested in getting close to their kids.
We have some other callers to talk with. Let's go to Bloomington, Indiana next. It's our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. May I ask what percentage of juvenile offenders come from inner-city broken families or from single-mother families, single mothers never had a husband?
Well, that's a good question, and there aren't national statistics on this. If you look at the numbers of kids, you would find that the majority of kids in the United States in facilities are from major urban areas, but that's only because of the population size and the concentration in those areas and the size of the facilities. If, for instance, I gave you the example of Chicago with a facility that has 498 beds, until the last 5 years, 5 or 6 years, that was 2/3 of the juvenile detention beds in the state of Illinois. Now that's turned, and the majority of beds are outside Cook County in Illinois as we built new and expanded facilities around the state. So numerically, the kids are – if you took kids charged with the most serious offenses out of 5 cities, didn't count them, it wouldn't be an issue at all. You know, you're talking about Miami, Detroit, yeah. Chicago, Los Angeles. If you took those out of the mix, it's not much of an issue at all, the most serious offenses.
But in the inner cities, it is an issue, isn't it? It's a big issue, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and here's the part of that we tend to use, and I'm not at all implying that you're using it that way, but we tend to use that phrase, inner city, as kind of a code for talking about children of color. And
right.
and here's the issue. If you went back and looked at the studies done by Sean McKay, for instance, of Cook County of Chicago from back in the day, what they found is that there are zones in every major metropolitan area, in Cook County specifically. Zone 1 would be the core of the city where the banks are and institutions. Zone 2 would be where poor people live.
Mm-hmm.
Zone 3 would be the transition zone. That's where people are coming out of that poorest area and starting to make a move out. Second generation immigrants, for instance, and we get to that transition area. Then there's the first level of suburbs, then the rich folks, if you follow me.
Sure. That's sociological. We used to call it a donut city or the donut layers.
Well, you got it. And here's what happened. When it was the Italian-Americans who lived in that inner city area, it was the Italian-Americans that had all the problems that we're talking about today. Drug abuse, alcohol abuse, unwed parenting, dysfunctional families, disorganized neighborhoods. But what happened by the second generation, the second generation of that immigrant population didn't dress like they were from another country, didn't talk like they were from another country, and moved out of that neighborhood, and they were accepted into the neighborhoods that they moved. And it didn't, the problem didn't follow them. Now, when it was the Irish Americans who were the immigrant population living in that inner city area, they had those same problems. Now, what's the difference today? The majority of people who live in that inner city area are people of color, black and brown people. And the difference is they can't change their color when they move out of that neighborhood. It's why, for instance, a black physician coming back from a seminar in Europe gets into his Mercedes at LA International and is driving home and is stopped by the police because he looks like a problem.
May I suggest another difference? Another difference might be that a lot of the inner city people have been on welfare, and welfare gave them an incentive not to get married, to bear children outside of wedlock. And it seems to me there's a great connection between single mother families who have born children out of wedlock, regardless of their color. But they usually are black, but regardless of their color, there's a connection between those single mothers and the absence of a decent male role model. And there's a real connection between the absence of decent male role models and crime. Is that right or not?
Well, it's certainly true that the majority of kids who are habitually involved in the system come from a single-parent home. In Texas, we talk about the common law marriage. We don't have common law marriage in Illinois. In Texas, we don't talk about single parents because we don't have that many kids who come from a single-parent home. While they're not legally married, they are common law married. In Illinois, we don't talk about that. But that would take it down to a much smaller number if we talked about people who are living together, who are the natural parents of a child.
But the problem is getting those young boys decent male role models.
It's one of the problems, certainly. Yeah. Certainly one of the contributing factors.
Thank you very much.
All right,
Let's
go to Champagne for someone else here, line number one.
Yeah.
Hello.
Originally, I was going to talk about the question that David asked about why it is that 36% of boys are likely to commit suicide or attempt to commit suicide in incarceration with adults, but you did answer that, but about sexual abuse and abuse in general. But I'm just wondering if you have any ideas about what can be done to stop that cycle or to make children less vulnerable or abusers less likely to abuse, which he's had shows about that, and it's very hard to stop that. Or it seems like it's a very... I remember speaking to someone who had been molested or raped by her mother's boyfriend, and her deepest resentment was towards her mother for having perhaps been an alcoholic or been unable to, you know, in denial about what was going on. So, I mean, it seems that women themselves need some kind of strength or support or sense that they don't need men that are going to abuse their children. Can you talk about that issue at all?
Well, let me go back to the number you started with, and it's not 36% of the kids. It's that a juvenile who's locked up is 36 times more likely.
Right. Sorry.
That still doesn't put it into even a majority of the juveniles. It's still a small part. No, it's hard to understand these numbers when you don't deal with them every day. I think that the answers to these issues are far beyond what the juvenile justice system can do. You know, it's the whole specter of human services, our education system. It's understanding that all of our people helping people serving agencies and services need to be about diagnostic, looking at these kinds of issues and looking for signs of the problem at the earliest stage. We shouldn't have to have a juvenile locked up when they're 15 years of age to learn that they were sexually abused from the time they were 3 years old. You know, someone should have caught that, the signs of that, early on. So the answer's too large for me But certainly I can point at issues that we need to just be more perceptive and more aware of the potential for this and looking for the signs.
And then there's another issue that you kind of went over, and it's just always been bamboozled me, this notion that, you know, juveniles who supposedly are not to be tried as adults are then tried as adults. How is it that we can make a law that says, you know, these are things that adults should be tried for, and these are things that a juvenile should be tried for? Or what? How do we get this move from saying this is a juvenile and then suddenly saying we're going to try you as an adult even though you're not an adult? What are the reasons for not trying a juvenile as an adult, and what kind of reasons, if there are any other than fear, that we turn around and then break that notion that we have in society that juveniles shouldn't be tried as adults and try them as adults?
You know, this is an issue that's not true just here, but it's true nationally, and it represents us across the world as well, as how we deal with juveniles. And what I would say is, I would like to see us think about it in different terms, and think about it in these terms, that juveniles, children in our country, enjoy a special relationship with the law, unless and until they commit certain offenses. If they commit those certain offenses, then they are tried in a criminal court. But if found guilty in that criminal court, they're dealt with in the juvenile system until they reach the age of majority. That's the change I'd like to see, that we don't put juveniles, children, into prisons, and we don't deal with them as if they're adults. They're not. We can deal with them as they're adults when they become an adult. And it doesn't mean that we're less serious with them. If you looked at the national numbers on this, kids charged with the same offenses, with the same kind of background and history, who are dealt with in the juvenile system, actually have greater sanctions or greater penalties against them than those that are transferred in the adult system. Because that judge in the adult system sees a child sitting there, and they deal with them differently than they do with an adult. And they will give that child less of a sentence than they would an adult who's sitting there for the obvious reasons. So what I'd like to see is that kind of a change, that only certain offenses, because now there's too much discretion involved. You know, it's up to a prosecutor to decide, you know, whether or not this juvenile should be tried as an adult. Well, it should be, in my mind, they should be tried in criminal court if they commit certain kinds of offenses. And I think we would probably we could probably sit down with a group of people and agree upon what those would be. Rape, kidnapping, murder, you know, that those offenses would be tried in a criminal court, and then we would deal with the person as a juvenile in the juvenile system until they reach the age of majority. Then we'd transfer them into the adult system.
Yeah. We're down to the point here where we have about 5-6 minutes left, and I have a couple of other callers, and I want to go to the next and at least get one more. There's someone listening this morning in Indiana, Hobart, Indiana. This is our line 4. Hello. Yeah,
good morning.
Yes.
I have two questions. Are you familiar with any type of work release or hort therapy program going on in Illinois or anywhere else?
Well, there are certainly, that's one of the competencies that we would try to build in juveniles is the, you know, employability training first. You know, many of the kids that we deal with in the system, again, and I'm not talking about all the kids, but many of the kids have never heard an alarm clock go off in their house. You know, they haven't had the same kind of socializing things happen in their life that many of us have had. They haven't been to a party to celebrate someone's graduation. They haven't been out to dinner to celebrate someone's promotion. All of those kinds of things that most of us have experienced in life help shape the way we view the world and what we expect from the world. Many of the kids in the system have had none of those kinds of experiences. So we have to help them build those competencies about, you know, what does it mean to be employable? And what kinds of things do you have to have, like an alarm clock, to get up and to get there on time, to look people in the eye when you talk to them, to offer a firm handshake and a straight look in the eye when you're greeting people. Simple things that, you know, that you and I would take for granted, kids in the system don't have those competencies.
Okay, so if I could contact you later after the program, you could direct me to some successful ongoing programs?
Absolutely.
Okay, second program. Although I ordinarily live in Bloomington, I am not familiar with any congregations, mainline congregations, that are actively intervening as mentors with these children. Are you familiar with any program of people of faith who have actually engaged in this, and could you recommend this?
Well, not denominational-wide, certainly, but certainly individual churches. And it seems to be more in the ecumenical reign of things, that churches who have served the same population from which the kids come are the ones typically who step forward to want to create programs to help those kids.
I see. Thank you.
All right. We'll see if we can get one more caller here back. Well, no, that we had someone in Urbana, but I guess they changed their mind. If they want to call real quick back, we see if we can get them in. Otherwise, we'll try. We'll chat here for another couple of minutes as our time winds down. I guess I'm interested in some of the comments you said at the beginning, where you talked about the fact that we're blurring the distinctions between the adult system and the juvenile system, and that we're tending more and more to treat juveniles at the same way that we treat adults, not with the same kinds of we don't make the distinctions. It seems that it's easier from a political standpoint to someone to talk about building prisons, locking people up, tough sentencing, mandatory sentencing, truth in sentencing. We've taken away a lot of sentencing discrimination from judges. They don't have the kind of control that they once had. And it's all a part of a posture that says we're tough on crime and we're not going to take it, and we're going to lock people up and we're going to throw away the key. It seems like that's an easier and sometimes a more productive argument for people to make than talking about alternatives.
Certainly. I think what passes for leadership out there in the communities many times is the person that sees where the lynch mob is going and runs and gets in front, that's seen as leadership. I think the central problem that we have in the justice system, especially in the juvenile justice system, is we treat some things that always have been as if they never were, and we treat some things that never were as if they always have been. And that's exactly the issue that we've got now, that building more prisons, locking more people up is going to make us safer. It never has and it never will. But helping people and helping people build competencies, engaging them, putting them in contact with people in positions of authority who respect them, who treat them with dignity, who have expectations for their behavior and hold them to those expectations, but do it in a kind and a loving way, that changes lives. That touches lives. That always has been and it always will be.
Try to get this Urbana caller in here, line one. Hello.
I have one quick question. You mentioned examples like, hearing an alarm clock in your house, going to someone's celebratory dinner for a job. Those type of experiences, it just reminded me very quickly of old IQ tests, where they expected the child to have a 9x12 bedroom, which was archaic and an odd idea for someone living in a one-room house with, five people. This seems to me that seems like an easy thing to screen, to check for, to address, just on a questionnaire. That if I ask 10 kids, this question, I should be able to address that in an academic setting early on. Is anything like that done?
Well, it certainly is done in isolated places and in isolated circumstances, but the difficulty is that most of us in human services have more than enough to say grace over. And so we aren't trying to expand the bounds of what we're responsible for. We try to narrow them down because there's only so much we can do. And those, when I suggested earlier that schools need to be more diagnostic, well, they've got enough to do to assess the academic ability of kids and then build on those kinds of skills. I'm not suggesting that they have the resources to do it now, but if we really do want to address these issues, we need to put the resources at the places that people come in contact with naturally as a flow of things. And for me, the obvious one is it's schools. And that needs to be one of the places where we can put people in contact with services and do screening for the things that they need.
I just read an article in the Chicago Tribune where they used an example of a subway attached to a church, a subway sandwich shop, where they were addressing those types of things with work training, people coming in for an application unable to do it and addressing it on the spot and using the sandwich shop as a training ground. Isn't church also a
at the gathering place, and it's certainly something that might be acceptable given the current climate of things in the administration.
It's certainly one of the avenues that could be used. I think that what I would suggest is that what it's going to require is that those of us who grew up with privilege understand what that privilege did for us and understand what that safety net did for us so that we can help create the same thing in the lives of others.
Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. We're here at the point where we're going to have to finish. Is there any last sort of thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
Well, it's disheartening to be in the system and see that it is, in a sense, a growth industry. I think that what I was hoping for when I got into the business 30 years ago was that we could somehow solve these problems and do away with juvenile crime. I think that that's not uncommon for people as they begin a profession. I think that what the years in the field have taught me is that what we need to be doing needs to be changed. We aren't going to solve the problem, but we can address it better.
Well, I thank you very much for coming and giving us some of your time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Stephen Kosman, he's Director of Probation for Peoria County.